Welcome to episode 74 of the Blooms and Barnacles podcast, where we talk about all things relating to James Joyce's Ulysses. I'm Dermot.
And I'm Kelly. And yes, I'm glad you pointed out that we talk about all things related to James Joyce's Ulysses, because this week we're going to take a little, let's say we're going to get off at an exit, take the scenic route, and then get back on the interstate in our next show. Does that metaphor work?
Sure, why not?
In the episode previous to this, we finished Calypso, Ulysses' fourth episode, and we are about to begin Lotus Eaters, the fifth episode of Ulysses. But I kind of like the idea of, in between these episodes, doing a topic that doesn't really fit into the flow of the rest of Ulysses. And that's kind of what we're doing tonight. So I'm assuming anyone who's listening to this is able to see the title and maybe even the episode description. So it's entitled Irish Orientalism. And a couple months back, we did a show called The Orientalism Show, where we talked about Orientalist themes in Ulysses. So you might want to check that one out if you're completely unfamiliar with Orientalism and how it relates to Ulysses. Or if you're feeling adventurous, just jump in here, because you certainly can. But we are going to go a little bit off topic. We will talk about James Joyce before the end, but there's going to be a big chunk up front where we talk about other things. We used to do episodes of Blooms and Barnacles where we would talk about some related cultural topic that would help readers get a better grip for Irish culture, the Irish psyche. How would you put it, Dermot? I used to have you kind of helm those episodes.
Yeah, kind of aspects of the Irish culture that might be unknown or lost to overseas. Irish people would know about them, but things like begrudgery and insecurity and that kind of thing.
Nostalgia and begrudgery were the two topics, which I think definitely play a role in Ulysses. And this one, I would never want to give anyone on the internet the impression that our show is responding to their nitpicky criticisms, but we did have someone kind of get their dander up in our Facebook group a while ago now when I talked about Orientalist themes in Ulysses. Anyway, this person said that Joyce would never give into the chauvinistic imperial mindset. And so this is saying maybe he did.
Maybe he was a human being and he wasn't a Superman.
Yeah, because cultural biases are much deeper than surface level. Well, anyway, we've got a little bit of business to get out of the way before we really get into the meat of this episode. First of all, Dermot is the artist for the podcast, and he's done some artwork for this episode that originally accompanied the blog post version of it, which you can find at our website,
bloomsandbarnacles.com,
under the title, Was Leopold Bloom Phoenician? He isn't, and he wasn't. But Dermot, can you tell us about the artwork you did for that blog post and this podcast episode? It's
pretty obviously inspired by the title. So it was just James Joyce as a Phoenician sailor, and trying to find visual reference for those Phoenician ships is not easy, because you get little reliefs there and they're flat. So it kind of looks vaguely Viking.
Mm-hmm.
And they have like a double ram head staff. That was like a real visual reference I got. So they were old bull worship or some stuff like that. And they had some weird god as well, the sea. I forget, but yeah.
If you refer to their gods as weird, you might be insulting our Phoenician listeners.
Well, they're all dead.
So. Well, as I mentioned, we are a blog as well as a podcast, and I'm really excited to announce a new blog post. It probably won't be finished on the same day this podcast comes out, but keep an eye on our social media as well as our website, which is
bloomsandbarnacles.com.
And it's entitled, Who is the Man in the Macintosh? So in the blog version of Blooms and Barnacles, we're on Hades. And this post has been an enormous undertaking, which is why I'm not sure if I will be done with it by this Wednesday, if you're listening in real time. But I am feeling optimistic about getting out by the end of the week, so I'm going to do my promo stuff for it now. And it's basically a post answering the question, who is the man in the Macintosh? And Dermot has done some artwork for it. Would you like to tell us about that?
Yeah, you gave me so many theories when you were researching, and I thought it's a Rorschach test. So then I thought I'll do a Rorschach from The Watchmen. Anyone familiar with Alan Moore's comic book Watchmen, or the movie adaptation that he hates, will recognize Rorschach with his face mask, which is a big Rorschach ink blot.
Mm-hmm. And you can see in the background Bloom and Joe Hines from the Freeman's Journal kind of stepping out from behind a tombstone in Glass Nevin, wondering who
is that weird guy.
Yeah. Keep an eye on our social media and our website for that. One thing we wanted to do to tie in with this blog post, because the identity of the man in the Macintosh from Ulysses is one of literature's great unsolved mysteries. There's never been a definitive answer. So we reached out to our listeners to get some of their theories about Macintosh's identity. I want to share a couple of them now, just to get you thinking about that. First of all, I realized from reaching out to our listeners, a lot of people are really into the idea that Macintosh is Joyce making a little cameo in Ulysses. If you want to know what I think about that theory, you'll have to check out the blog post. I'm going to have Dermot here read another one that one of our followers on Twitter shared from @I'mNotDeadless.
I like Duffy for him, assuming Macintosh is real, which I do, and not just a symbol of chaos or a wandering ghost. And if you follow the interpretation that Macintosh set the fire at the end of Oxen, then good Christ, in the 7 or 8 months since Sinico's death, old Duffy Don broke bad.
So that's a popular theory that Macintosh is actually James Duffy, who is the main character from the Dubliner short story, A Painful Case, and a theory I will discuss in the blog post. So to see if I agree with this listener or not, you'll have to check out the blog post. I do have one quibble with you, sir, and I think you are a sir. I would say a wandering ghost could also be real. All right. And we got another response via email from listener Jack.
If you paid attention to the Odyssey, you know that Athena appears throughout as a protector of Odysseus, his shield or Aegis. She also appears in many guises, young shepherd, old man, beautiful maiden. So there it is. The MITM in Ulysses is Athena.
I read many different Homeric parallels for Man in the Macintosh, but Jack is the only one who suggested Athena, and I liked his because I got lots of suggestions. I think this was the only one I didn't encounter somewhere else, so good on you, Jack. And I do go into Homeric parallels for the Man in the Macintosh. If you want to know what they are and what I think of them, what can they do, Dermot?
Bloomsandbarnacles.com.
Check out that blog post. It should be up by the end of this week. Yeah, and to find out my personal theories, some of which I debunk, check out our blog post. And if you would like to participate in our next question of the month, you can follow us on Twitter or Facebook or subscribe to our newsletter, which you can do at our website.
Bloomsandbarnacles.com.
Thank you, Dermot. And finally, we do want to say thank you to our donor for this fortnight.
Thank you to Andrew Tor.
Thank you very much. We really do appreciate the donations. They help us pay for our web hosting and coffee and many other things integral to bringing you this podcast every 2 weeks. If someone would like to donate, Dermot, how might they do that?
Again, on the website, bloomsandbarnacles.com, and top right of the page, we have a little tip jar.
Mm-hmm. It says donate. It'll take you to our PayPal and you can put money there. I guess I'm a bit dense. I hadn't noticed this until recently, but a handful of people have set up recurring donations, so if you really do like us, that's something you could do, and it really does help us. We appreciate it immensely. So, well, without further ado, let's talk about Ireland in 1904. What was it like?
It was lovely.
It was. Do you want to elaborate on that?
No, I'm being sarcastic.
Okay. In the first Orientalism episode, which again is entitled The Orientalism Show, we talked about how the Orientalist motifs in Ulysses are a product of British colonialism. After all, Ireland in 1904 was considered part of the United Kingdom and had been a part of the UK since the Act of Union in 1801. And Dublin at that time, rather than being a capital city, was sort of a secondary city within the UK. Ireland itself was seen by some as West Britain, quote-unquote. How would you describe West Britain?
A serious slur if you were to call somebody a West Brit. The implication being that they don't see themselves as Irish, that they're really British, which is fine if you're from the Orange community up in the north. But for anybody who isn't, it will be seen as you're not really Irish.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You're always looking to London and tugging the forelock to the Queen.
Mm-hmm. In this case, really, that Ireland was just sort of naturally part of Britain.
Yep.
It's a separate island, but due to factors like geographic proximity, a shared language, which was imposed on them, and skin color, Ireland's similarity in these ways to Britain kind of meant in some people's eyes that this union was inevitable and natural. Hmm. Now, there are definitely people who don't feel that way as well. So as we mentioned, Ireland's part of the UK, but I think we tend to look at the Irish as people living in a colony, right? Their country was colonized by the British. Mm-hmm. But the Irish had sort of an unusual relationship with British imperialism, especially the Irish middle and upper classes, that really differed from other subjects of the British Empire. I'm thinking of like people in parts of Asia and Africa. So Dublin itself was for many centuries the center of British rule in Ireland. And it was at the center of a region called the Pale. So have you ever heard something described as beyond the Pale? It's kind of contrasting anglicized Dublin with the outlands outside the kind of seat of British power.
And I think the Pale extended south too.
Yes.
Just south of my hometown, Arklow.
It would have included like Kildare and places like that. Yeah. The anglicized people who lived within the Pale considered themselves several steps above socially the folks outside of the Pale.
And they still do.
Mm-hmm. And this is a good vocabulary corner for our non-Irish listeners. Mm-hmm. What would you refer to someone living outside the Pale?
Well, Dubliners refer to everybody living outside of Dublin as Culchies. C-U-L-C-H-E-E or I-E. And so that's a rural bumpkin, redneck. Mm-hmm. In Ireland, it's Culchie. But a lot of town people would regard people from, say, the west of the Shannon or whatever as Culchies. It varies. They have a movable feast. Depends on who you want to look down on. Mm-hmm. But yeah, there's layers of Culchies.
But even within Irish society, it was possible to become a bit more English or to follow, mm-hmm. I think, English culture in a way that was not typical of other parts of the British Empire. Yeah. And it really informed the social strata in Ireland at that time. So to give an example from Ulysses, let's think back to Telemachus. Remember Buck Mulligan? Mm-hmm. Someone like Buck Mulligan, who's from maybe more of an upper class family, he would have more in common with an English person of similar class stature than with a tenant farmer in the west of Ireland. And that's kind of what makes his presence so grating to Stephen, is this kind of class-based and imperialistic snobbery. Mulligan is happy to accommodate Haynes's quirks, mm-hmm. and kind of kiss his butt while relentlessly mocking Stephen, because an Irish artist is only fit for mockery in the eyes of the ascendancy, while an English-born, Oxford-educated hack is still seen as superior, even though Stephen, as we know, is a superior intellect to Haynes. Or at least Haynes is more worth touching for a guinea here and there, in as much as he has them. The influence of British rule over Ireland also influenced Ireland's relationship to areas of the world considered the Orient. How would you describe the Orient during
At this time, as per Edward Said's definition, anything in North Africa, Asia, any part of Asia, even parts of Europe could fall under Oriental. Mm-hmm. Moorish Spain, I guess Constantinople's technically in Europe, but it would be considered Oriental. Mm-hmm. And it was like a catch-all, elemental word to describe this heterogeneous group of countries and cultures that are very different from one another. So it flattens this huge variety of countries and cultures into one thing, one word, one idea.
Mm-hmm. Right. And people in Britain and Ireland at that time were fairly fascinated with the Orient. It was seen as this mysterious place. And characters in Ulysses as well are often fascinated by their idea of what the Orient must be like, especially Leopold Bloom, which we've discussed in the past. The imaginations of characters like Bloom are informed by both high culture and low culture rather than any kind of direct experience. But because of this, these opinions and fantasies are often filtered through the lens of Imperial Britain. So if, let's say, Leopold Bloom is reading about what life is like in the Orient, maybe in Palestine, where he could buy some land or, you know, something like that. He's reading probably from publications that were, if they're printed in English, were printed for the consumption of citizens of the UK and, mm-hmm. you know, the case of Ireland. Leopold Bloom, for his part, is often characterized as foreign and quote-unquote Oriental because of his Jewish and Hungarian heritage. But even given that, he's a native Dubliner, and he really doesn't have a very sophisticated view of what the Orient is actually like. He kind of relies on, like, a stereotypical image. So in the opening pages of Lotus Eaters, he passes in Dublin city centre the Belfast and Oriental Tea Company, and he thinks,
"Those Sinhalese lobbing around in the sun, in dolce far niente, not doing a hand's turn all day, sleep 6 months out of 12.
What do you get from reading that?
Yeah, every awful cliche about people who aren't English doing no work and they, until some Englishman comes around and gets them to build a bridge.
Yep. Yeah, and I think, too, I look at this as he's thinking about, I don't know if he's thinking about workers for the Belfast and Oriental Tea Company, but I bet if you're working for a colonial tea company, you're not sleeping 6 months out of 12. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not a very realistic view of people living in Ceylon, which Sinhalese would live in the island of Ceylon, now called Sri Lanka. It's a stereotype of colonial subjects of South Asia being far less industrious than their British masters. And it comes so easily to his mind. Like, there aren't a lot, when we read this more closely, we see there aren't a lot of steps between, there's a tea company, Tom Kernan works there. Boy, those people are lazy. Isn't that great? Like, he likes it. Like, he's not, you know, really a Mr. Deasy, like, oh, those layabouts. He's just like, oh, that'd be great. But it seems to be a bias that he's absorbed and kind of integrated pretty deeply. And he's just picked it up from the colonial culture around him. Despite the fact that he is Irish and also a colonial subject, he definitely has kind of British colonialist view of the people of Ceylon. Mm-hmm. Another example that we'll see much later in Lotus Eaters is that Buddha statue in the National Museum that he remembers going to see. I'm not going to say much more about that. According to Irish journalist Fintan O'Toole, that Buddha statue was stolen by an Irishman in the British Army on a punitive mission to Burma in the 1880s and then brought back to Ireland about a decade later. So, in some ways, this will be a controversial statement, but don't turn the podcast off here and email me. Listen to the end. In some ways, people in Ireland benefited from colonialism in terms of maybe a culinary benefit or a cultural benefit. At least people in middle and upper classes seem to be receiving some benefits from being in West Britain.
I would stress the upper classes.
Yes.
And those in the lower classes were getting stuffed good and hard.
Yes.
I mean, it's a fair comment. Like George Orwell said that the British working class was in India. And, you know, having a group of people even more exploited than your own working class means the life of your own domestic working class can be slightly less hellish. So this is where some people go off the rails completely and go, oh, you were all complicit in the empire. I've heard people pull that one and you can pull the other one, you know. Mm-hmm. But no, it's this enormous crap show mm-hmm. where, you know, you're trying to pull the whole thing apart. It's very easy to get lost in weeds.
Yeah.
But definitely to the Irish upper class. I would say to this day, a lot of them looked more toward London than they do toward themselves. And that reminds me too, like back in the late 80s, early 90s, the Irish government hired a British company to do a study of what was wrong with Ireland and the Irish culture. And they paid them like something like £10 million. And the result came back basically saying you should be more self-reliant. Mm. Now, you're paying $10 million to a bunch of British people to tell us to be more self-reliant. What does that tell you? You know, apart from being funny, it's also kind of obscene. But that kind of sense of like that gnawing sense of insecurity, I think, still exists. Maybe less so now than it did. But I can still detect that, like in the stuff that I read on Irish media, it's like you're still nodding toward London. It's like, get over it.
So I'm going to pose this question, which, again, I know is controversial, but it's going to inform our discussion. Are the Irish the victims of colonial rule or beneficiary citizens of the United Kingdom actually profiting from imperial plunder. So as we'll see going forward, it's very, very complicated. We've only got an hour here, so we're going to kind of scratch the surface. And yeah, to answer it quickly, I'm going to say it's very complicated and it depends on what social class you were in. Because the Irish culture of Joyce's era, looking at 1904, that early Edwardian period, it was so steeped in British influence that it could be hard to tell where British influence ended and Irish culture began. They're in the same swim, as Leopold Bloom said. So from an English point of view, or from a colonialist point of view, some people believe that the Irish were these sort of uncivilized barbarians until the English arrived on their shores and kind of whipped them into shape. So it would follow then that Irish peasants were poor, not because of the English, but because they were Irish, because they possessed some inherently indigent quality that resulted in their lowly status. So think of people like Mr. Deasy and his insistence that the pride of the English was that they could pay their own way and never incurred any debts. This is kind of my point. A lot of readers will think that, oh, Mr. Deasy is an Englishman, but he is not. Mr. Deasy is Irish. He's just as Irish as Stephen Dedalus or Leopold Bloom. But in Irish people of a certain social class, you know, this was almost a stereotypical view that Mr. Deasy could take on this archetypical role.
Because he's a West Brit.
Yes. So this belief paints the English as inherently middle class, always possessed of the money that they need to live, while the flip side of that is that Irish people are inherently poor and by their nature don't value economics and prosperity in the same way as the English. And in turn, this lets the ruling classes off the hook for maintaining such an unequal society, because there's no need to reform a society if the people living it are incapable of, quote unquote, bettering themselves. Their poor state is simply God's will. And that's how many viewed the Irish. So it's a very unfair view. And I think it definitely allowed really horrific conditions within Ireland. Dublin, I think, was one of the poorest cities in Europe at this time. Obviously, there had been a terrible famine in the 1840s, evictions, a land war, all of this stuff, the penal laws before that. The British did a lot of bad things to the Irish. But let's look at another group, the Protestant ascendancy. So I'm going to use this term a lot. What does that mean, the Protestant ascendancy?
The people who were descended from English settlers or families that are married into the English ruling class. So they weren't strictly from, if you want, bloodlines. They weren't pure, like, Irish family. They weren't Murphys and O'Connors in there. You'd see different names. And they might send their kids to Oxford or Cambridge if they could afford it. And they would inside track or fast track to power. So whereas if you're Catholic born, then you'd have sweet if all chance of getting it far in life. But if you're born into the ascendancy class, then you have a silver spoon in your proverbial mouth. So,
Yeah. So you can see that there was a lot of inequality in Irish society. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the Celtic revivalists. So while the Protestant ascendancy benefited, I think, from the inequality of British colonialism, this class of people also produced its fair share of revolutionaries, such as Maud Gonne. And it also produced the Celtic revival movement in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. So these were, you know, they were people who wanted to promote the use of the Irish language. And they were also writers who we're going to focus on for our purposes, who wanted to counteract these assumptions of British supremacy we just talked about, and to create a literature and an art form that was purely Irish and grew out of Irish art forms and Irish culture. So these are writers like William Butler Yeats, Lady Philippa Gregory, both of whom we've talked about quite a bit on this podcast. We did an episode called The Holy Office. That's a good one to check out if you want to hear us talk about that. Their works aimed to depict a Gaelic Ireland, or a pre-Norman invasion Ireland, devoid of any English influence, and centering the Irish language and Irish mythology as its main subjects. Many of these artists drew inspiration from interacting with Irish people native to the west of Ireland in regions like Connemara and the Aran Islands. But interestingly enough, their representation of this purer, quote-unquote, Ireland follows a lot of the patterns of Orientalism we talked about in a previous show. These were very highly idealized representations of an Irish identity. So it's an image of Ireland as a magical land populated by gods and mythical creatures and strange, sexy, and otherworldly women. Other artists depicted very pious, innocent peasants living in harmony with the land, upholding these nearly forgotten traditions. And this fantastical, again, quote-unquote, pure Ireland stood as a counterpoint to the rational, technological modernity of British imperialism and offered a spiritual alternative to this sort of rational progress. It in no way reflected the lived experience of the people who made their homes in rural Ireland, and it instead reflected an idealized idea of Ireland that appealed to wealthy Anglo-Irish people.
So that meant well. But yeah, the end result, I think, yeah, I'm not going to call them malevolent or anything, but it was a two-dimensional view of, like, multidimensional people.
And they had an agenda.
Yeah. Look, people keep doing this today. I could spin, like, for another half hour talking about how we project cartoons onto the Middle East to this day, only they're horror movies, you know, and it drives people kind of nuts. And now we project these flat cartoons onto other people in our own countries. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you're a Nazi, you're a Marxist and all this rubbish. And these people are doing it in a way that's like benign because they're making like a happy little cartoon. But yeah, you're putting a barrier between you and reality.
Mm-hmm. Right. And just as English writers of this time took traditional stories from maybe the Middle East and then retooled them to appeal to Europeans in works like A Thousand and One Nights, which Joyce was so fond of, the Celtic revivalists took Irish folklore and translated it for a Victorian audience. And when I say they translated it, they changed the stories to kind of reflect the values of that era. Mm. So you take like a once lusty hero like Cú Chulainn, and suddenly he becomes very chaste when he's constrained by Victorian mores. But, you know, a lot of these stories, too, had already been through the filter of the monks. Early Christian church who had written them down first. It had been an oral tradition before that, so there's that as well. Anyway, I'm getting out ahead of myself here. Much like Orientalist stereotypes of the Middle East or Asia, this mythical stereotype of Ireland, as you pointed out, does survive into the 21st century. Interestingly enough, there are some points of view that Ireland's origin does come from the Orient. What? Well, let's look at it. So let's talk about the Book of Invasions. Do you know the Book of Invasions?
Yeah, I've never read it. I've only ever heard about it.
Well, I'm going to put a link to it in our show notes. So if you'd like to read it, you can. It's a medieval manuscript. So great beach read that tells of Ireland's origin story. And even in Irish myth, you know, Ireland is an island that's experienced many waves of invaders that have changed or, you know, altered the makeup of that island in some way. And when we look at, like, you know, history, we've got the Gaels, we've got Vikings, Normans, etc., etc., you know. So that checks out. The Book of Invasions is mythical, but aspects of its tales were sometimes taken as fact or near fact, even into the era in which Ulysses was written. It tells of a succession of monsters and gods who fought and deposed one another for control of Ireland until a group called the Milesians showed up and kind of took the wheel. The Milesians are the mythological equivalent of the historic Gaels, and they are the forebears of the people today that we call Irish. So the Gaels would have also populated Scotland and the Isle of Man, Ireland. They're those guys. In mythology, the Milesians were said to have descended from Noah's son Japhet in the Near East. And the Milesians then, as a group spent time in Scythia and Egypt before setting sail through the Mediterranean and then heading for Ireland via Iberia, which is the peninsula that's now home to modern-day Spain and Portugal. And the Milesians take their name from their leader Milesius, whose Latinized name is derived from the phrase Miles Hispaniae, or soldier of Hispania, or Spain. So one thing I learned when I was originally researching this is that there is recent DNA evidence that indicates that the Neolithic inhabitants of Ireland, so like the people who built Newgrange, were likely dark-skinned people with DNA from the Near East, who were genetically distinct from the Mesolithic people that they displaced and from the Gaels who were believed to have arrived during the Bronze Age and displaced these Neolithic people. Mm. So I was ready when I first wrote this to just be like, this is all nonsense. But it makes me wonder, like, if there is some kind of very, very distant factual predecessor for this. I mean, there's no way of knowing because these stories were first written down, you know, by Christian monks, like thousands of years after the Neolithic people would have lived there. But it's just kind of interesting. So let's fast forward from the Bronze Age and the arrival of the mythical Milesians to the 17th century and talk about a man named Roderick O'Flaherty. He wrote a book called Ogygia, in which he posited that the Irish people originated in Phoenicia and migrated over the sea to Ireland. So the name Ogygia might be familiar because that was Calypso's island in the Odyssey, where Odysseus was marooned for over 20 years. Right? And we have an episode that's just called Calypso, where we talked about how that island is thought to be near Gibraltar in the kind of western extremes of the Mediterranean, which if you were Phoenician was like the other end of the known world, right? If your domain was the Mediterranean. O'Flaherty believed that Homer, who was believed by some to be Phoenician in origin, was referring to Ireland when he wrote about Odysseus being trapped on Ogygia. So this 17th century writer thought that Calypso's island was Ireland. Hmm. O'Flaherty borrowed heavily from myths similar to those found in the Book of Invasions to get the ancient Phoenicians to Ireland, right? It kind of fits. Hmm. You're connecting a couple of dots there. Interestingly enough, O'Flaherty's Phoenician hypothesis had traction. It stuck around and it held on into the 20th century. When I did research for this, I found as late as 1922, a book published by the Oxford University Press explained that Ireland was first settled by the Phoenicians and that the ruins of Dunangus, which is an Iron Age hill fort, I think on Inishmore in the Aran Islands, that Dunangus was built by the Phoenicians as well. You have any thoughts on this so far?
No. I mean, I'm familiar with Bob Quinn's well-known documentary called Atlantean. I think he's alive. I think the video is available. You can buy it on Amazon. Where his argument was that there was a continuous cultural exchange or a culture between Ireland and Morocco, mm-hmm. based on the fact that a lot of Irish music and Moroccan music sounds eerily similar, but there's no real archaeological evidence mm-hmm. for it. So whether, you know, it's possible that some travel happened between the two places to cross-contaminate them mm-hmm. or influence one another, I don't know. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I would suspect, you know, people have this idea today that the distances were so vast. I think people got around a lot more mm-hmm. than we think. I think we'd be surprised. I know there was one artifact that was found in Ireland that had the Arabic, there was no Gapa Allah written on it. Mm-hmm. So there was some trading went on, whether an actual person from the Middle East came to Ireland or not, I don't know. Mm-hmm. The one example from history I could give of a major cultural impact by one person is there was a famous musician and courtier in Baghdad who moved to Umayyad Spain, and this would have been around the year 900 or 1000 AD, and he basically, this one person had this vast influence on the Spanish court, the Moorish court. And he brought like fashions and musical styles and literary styles with him. So it's not beyond the realms of possibility that one person could you know, have like this enormous impact, but we'll never know.
Mm-hmm. Let's keep looking. So, like I said, this idea kind of stuck around. In the 18th century, a man named Charles Valency wrote a very detailed linguistic, or they would have called it philological, analysis of the Irish language, where he, in his mind, tied it definitively to the Semitic language spoken by the ancient Phoenicians. Without getting too much in the weeds on this, this is not at all the conclusion of modern linguistics, 21st century linguistics, but Charles Valency really believed his own linguistic analysis and was positive that the Irish language was the Phoenician language. We'll just leave that there for now. Poet Thomas More believed that the Irish were actually descended from the ancient Persians, and even in his writing attempted to draw a parallel between the Zoroastrian fire temples of antiquity and the round towers found in many early Christian sites in Ireland, though he seemed to be alone in that assertion. I don't think that got beyond Thomas More.
Yeah.
But this linking of Ireland to the Phoenicians is particularly key, since the Phoenicians held colonies throughout the Mediterranean, such as Carthage in modern-day Tunisia and in Iberia. They kind of followed the path of the Milesians in the Book of Invasions.
Mm.
So it's kind of interesting,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah. Could be a folk memory. A lot of stuff survives. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that brings us to the idea of Irish Orientalism, which is what we've been discussing here. It's the imagining of the Orient as this mythical Eden, whence the Irish sprung. So the historical Gaels, as we mentioned, don't seem to have any connection linguistically or otherwise to Semitic people in the Near East. I'm pretty sure Milesius only existed in myth. Sorry.
Mm-hmm.
and it feels very easy to just toss these ideas out as being very silly or fantastical. Like, they don't really fit our modern scientific analysis of these things, because we have DNA now. But a DNA-informed notion of the world is incredibly recent. I mean, really within the last few decades. And to try to adjust our mindset to think about what the world must have looked like pre-DNA analysis and the kind of, you know, evidence that brings, that helps us get into the mindset of the people who lived in James Joyce's time. Into the mindset of what people would have been like in 1904, and honestly what people would have been like in the 1920s when Ulysses was published. Moving on from that, why Irish Orientalism, right? The Irish people are the subjects of imperialistic subjugation. Why are they also doing Orientalism? Surely they would not possess the chauvinism of the British imperial mindset. The Irish are separate, right?
Yeah, we're better than them.
You know, if you have been oppressed by, you know, these jerks who live next door to you, sorry, British listeners, this allows Irish people to discover a hidden past that is steeped in nobility and grandeur. It's sort of like realizing as a culture that you're actually a wizard rather than a sad kid who lives under a staircase.
Hmm.
Or insert your preferred pop cultural reference there, because there's a lot of stories like that. Ireland occupied a very lowly position within the British Empire. As I mentioned, Dublin was one of the poorest cities in Europe at the turn of the last century. As Joseph Lennon, who wrote a book entitled Irish Orientalism, put it, that Ireland's purported connection to the Orient symbolizes rather than this, you know, kind of downtrodden view of their culture, or this view of their culture that it is God's will that they're indigence. Instead, connecting themselves to this sort of glorious past in the Orient, it symbolizes immutability, right? They've always been there, antiquity, they're very ancient, in perpetuity, so they have a future as well. A connection with an ancient lineage, such as the Phoenicians, is proof that the Irish were embarrassed kings rather than, you know, barbarians or West Britons. And one day they would rise again, right? Mm. This whole British imperialism thing is just a, you know, it's It's just like a bad season, man. Mm. They're going to be back on top someday. An ancient lineage in the Orient, in the Near East, also divorced Ireland from English rule. And that meant that the Irish were perfectly capable of ruling themselves, right? They weren't just a bunch of filthy barbarians. Then the English came and kind of cleaned them up. They had this great, glorious past. And so, you know, it shows that they weren't by their nature colonial subjects. They could be rulers as well. This notion has very real-world political implications in this era, especially leading up to 1916 and the Irish War for Independence, where the Irish are trying to prove that they can be independent. So another key idea to really help us understand the appeal of Irish Orientalism is to understand, again, that the influence of the English on Ireland was so dominant, and that's because English culture really had been forced on the Irish, right? Their language, their religion to a certain extent, a belief that the Irish had roots outside, you know, unconnected mm-hmm. from the English, it shows that their destiny was not naturally and by God's will connected to the English rule. Mm-hmm. So I think a lot of this really appealed in a time when the idea of an independent Ireland was growing and growing. While Ireland and England had been historically intertwined, they didn't have to be. So it's worth pointing out, too, that Irish Orientalism was mainly a hobby of the middle and upper classes that we mentioned earlier, much like Celtic revivalist literature. And part of this was because the wealthy classes in England were getting a bigger proportion of the colonial spoils than were the wealthy classes in Ireland. The wealthy in Ireland wanted their share, what they thought was their fair share, and they also felt that they were on par socially with their English peers. They were not, you know, second-run nobility. They wanted to be viewed as equals with the big wigs in England. Mm. Revivalist literature didn't imagine an Ireland for everyone. It portrayed an Ireland that was the birthright of an Irish nobility. It had the same rigid class structure that existed in English society. It was just more Irish. Orientalism in any form is a tool of nationalism, and it can be manipulated to justify exploitation on the part of the wealthy. And Irish Orientalism could be used in much the same way by pointing out an ancient noble lineage to argue that the wealthy Irish were just as entitled to imperialist largesse as the wealthy English.
And the working class Irish should know their place.
Yes, as serfs. Mm. Yeah, so, yeah. It's nice to think like we're creating our own literature that's made by the Irish for the Irish, but it's not really egalitarian. Mm. All of this is done just kind of to benefit the upper classes. Mm-hmm. So where does James Joyce fit into all of this, you may be asking? Well, Joyce, for his part, was fascinated by the notion of the Orient. That kind of fascination, I think, wove its way into Ulysses. As a young man, a lot of his familiarity was mainly funneled through like popular works, like we mentioned, A Thousand and One Nights, and through spiritualism and sort of these Anglo-Irish spiritualists like W.B. Yeats and A.E. Russell. That when he finally got out of Ireland, Joyce moved to Trieste, which is now in modern-day Italy, but at that time was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and he experienced for the first time life in a very diverse city at the crossroads of East and West. And he made friends there who were quite different from his friends from home. You know, a big example of that would be his friend Ettore Schmitz, who he would later base Leopold Bloom on. And for a young Dubliner in the early 1900s, Trieste was oriental enough to really open his eyes to what the world was like outside of Dublin. As far as like Orientalist academic studies, Joyce had a very complicated view on those. Because on one hand, he was really fascinated by learning about the language and culture of the East. On the other hand, he also felt that the students of these topics were furthering the cause of the imperialist British government. So, you know, a lot of the English language studies that were available of language, culture, religion, anything from the quote-unquote Orient was a project of imperialism. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Well, Joyce also kind of let us know what he thinks about this, specifically Irish Orientalism. In 1907, Joyce gave a lecture in Trieste that was entitled Ireland, Island of Saints and Sages, where he promoted that Phoenician hypothesis to an Italian audience. And I'm going to have Dermot here read a fairly lengthy quote from that. It's available for free online. The link will be in the show notes at bloomsandbarnacles.com. Anyway, thus spake Joyce.
The Irish language is Oriental in origin and has been identified by many philologists with the ancient language of the Phoenicians, the originators of trade and navigation, according to historians. This adventurous people, who had a monopoly of the sea, established in Ireland a civilization that had decayed and almost disappeared before the first Greek historian took his pen in hand. It jealously preserved the secrets of its knowledge, and the first mention of the island of Ireland in foreign literature is found in a Greek poem of the 5th century before Christ, where the historian repeats the Phoenician tradition. The language that the Latin writer of comedy Plautus put in the mouth of Phoenicians in his comedy Penelus is almost the same language that the Irish peasants speak today, according to the critic Valenci.
Any thoughts on that?
I hope I pronounced Penelus right. It sounds like pretty much what you've been discussing, mm-hmm. like verbatim, and the dodgy philology, which he couldn't be blamed for. He wasn't an expert in Phoenician, I assume. Mm-hmm. So you had to pick your experts, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so Joyce was very taken by this idea. And when he mentions the first mention of the island of Ireland in foreign literature is found in a Greek poem of the 5th century before Christ, he's referring to the Odyssey there.
Mm.
And that Roderick O'Flaherty idea that, you know, Calypso's island was Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
So Ireland's reputation as a land of saints and sages, or saints and scholars, as is sometimes known, is tied to this early Irish Christian tradition of sending its leading holy men to continental Europe in order to spread the faith. You might remember back in Proteus, Stephen mockingly likens himself traveling to Paris as a most unsaintly young man to early Christian saints like Columbanus and Fiacre, who were canonized for their efforts on the continent. Joyce seems particularly taken here with Valency's linguistic analysis, and Joyce goes on to argue in this lecture that the sages, when we refer to Ireland as the land of saints and sages, that those sages were referring to the wise men of ancient Phoenicia, and the saints, rather than being Catholic saints, were priests of ancient Egypt who traveled to Ireland in antiquity and became the Druids. A very, very long time ago. So Joyce's embrace of the Phoenician hypothesis kind of does one better. So it not only decouples Ireland's history from Britain, but also from the supremacy of the Catholic Church. Ireland was populated by wise men and holy men thousands of years before Patrick ever so much as imagined a shamrock. That is the ancient birthright of the Irish. This ancient wisdom existed in Ireland from time immemorial. It was the birthright of its people. It was separate from the church. And Ireland's successful monastics then did not arise as a result of Christian enlightenment, but because of the nature of their ancient Oriental roots. An Irish-Phoenician connection adds a layer of understanding to Joyce's characterization of Leopold Bloom as well. Joyce was very fond of French writer Victor Bérard's analysis of the Odyssey, and it was Bérard who asserted that Odysseus was himself a Phoenician. Therefore, if you're writing about an Irish everyman Odysseus, he has to be Phoenician in his distant ancestry, as Joyce pointed out in this lecture, and in his connection to Odysseus. Bloom represents this heritage. He is both Irish and Semitic. And Dublin itself takes on the similar hybrid quality in Ulysses as it transforms through metempsychosis into the ancient Mediterranean as Bloom Odysseus voyages throughout. Joyce's embrace of the Phoenician hypothesis allowed him to imagine an Ireland with diverse inhabitants. And I think this is really, really key here, because this is, he did not like those Celtic revivalists. If you listen, especially to our episode called The Holy Office, Joyce really had no time for the Celtic revivalists. And his embrace of this Phoenician idea really set him apart from the Celtic revivalists, because in that revivalist literature, there is this current that underlies everything of racial purity, of a mythic Ireland, of a true Irish culture, unadulterated by foreign invaders, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that racial purity is a key component of Celtic revival, of saying there is a specific kind of person who is Irish, and, mm-hmm. you know, it's a closed-door country club. Not everyone can make it in. Not the English, and not the Leopold Blooms either.
Everyone's Irish when they get a medal in the Olympics or they score a goal mm-hmm. in the World Cup. That's my acid test. There's a right-wing politician in Britain called Norman Tebbit, and in the 80s he did this horrible thing called the cricket test, and it was aimed at Pakistani immigrants to Britain. And he asked them, when Pakistan plays the English cricket team, which team do you cheer for? In other words, if you cheer for Pakistan, you're not really English. I'd invert that, you know, to the bigots. It's like, how pure is your race realism when there's a World Cup goal or an Olympic medal on the line? You'll find people become really, really inclusive really, really quickly. Or a Nobel Prize. Oh, he's Irish. You know, the fact that most of our Nobel Prize winners are like, you know, maybe half Anglo or two-thirds Anglo or ascendancy or whatever. Oh, no, they're all Irish. They count. You know, so whatever you're going to do, just be consistent about it. Mm-hmm. Of course, racists are never consistent about anything.
Sure. And Joyce, for his part, to get moved from the Olympics back to Joyce, in drawing parallels between Ireland and the Orient, he wasn't just creating a playground for nobles to, you know, for the aristocracy to claim some ancient lineage. Mm-hmm. He was, in his own words, using this as a way to reject, quote, the old path of racial hatred. Right. So it very much was in his mind. Joyce certainly does play into racial and ethnic stereotypes in Ulysses. I mean, there are definitely ethnic slurs in Ulysses, but he also envisions a modern Ireland that has room for people like Leopold and Molly, who are undeniably Irish, but are also just foreign enough for their Irishness to be questioned or qualified by their peers, even by one another. Joyce wanted to see an Ireland that would become more forward-thinking. So you remember, he kind of draws a line between Buck Mulligan, who wants to Hellenize Ireland, and Stephen, who kind of wants to continentalize Ireland. He doesn't want to look to the ancients in Greece. He wants to look to continental writers like Ibsen. Hmm. He thinks that's the way forward, this James Joyce thinks. A key component to nurturing a worldly Ireland is to embrace the nation's diversity. Consider in Cyclops the citizens' rejection of Bloom as Irish, where Bloom really has to defend himself as an Irishman. As someone who was born in Dublin, he has to defend to this old bigot, I am just as Irish as you. The citizen and characters like the citizen represent this insular view of the Irish people, that there's a pure Irish people. So it's no mistake then that when you look at the narrative of Cyclops, it's kind of interspersed with these spoofs of old Irish myth that was so beloved by the revivalists. Mm-hmm. You can hear some of that in our most recent Bloomsday episode. Anyway, the revivalist ideas belong to this long dead past. They are not the lived reality of actual Dubliners, right? And when you have this past that's kind of, you know, dead, and it's not really real, and it doesn't really have any connection to living people, you can kind of manipulate it to say whatever you want it to say. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a closer here. In an essay entitled Phoenician Genealogies and Oriental Geographies, Joyce, Language and Race by Elizabeth Butler Cullingford, she wrote,
Leopold Bloom, a peripatetic Jew whose ethnic identity is uncertain, who fantasizes about the Orient and who was subjected to the racial hatred of Irish nationalists, embodies Joyce's affirmation of cultural hybridity throughout the myth of wandering Ulysses, the Semitic Phoenician.
So you can see how Joyce kind of incorporates these ideas that seem kind of loopy when they're presented in isolation, mm-hmm. and he uses them to build Leopold Bloom, who's a very enduring literary character. And I think even reading it in 2021, readers really connect with him. And he's someone you'd recognize in your own city, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It would be pretty rare to live in a major city anywhere in the world that's all one race of people.
Yeah.
I mean, I would argue it just doesn't exist. Anyway, in closing, through Bloom, we find the Medes to build a new Bloomusalem, a modern Ireland with room for all people.
Amen.
The end.
There we go.
All right. Well, in 2 weeks, we'll start talking about lotus eaters, which definitely has some Orientalism in it.
Good.
I hope we can leave you all with a new view on Orientalism and Ireland's relationship to it. And with that, I bid you adieu.
Good night.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to the Blooms and Barnacles podcast. Your support means the world to us. You can subscribe to Blooms and Barnacles on Apple Podcasts, Google Play Music, Stitcher, Spotify, or any other place you listen to podcasts. You can also stream our episodes at our website, bloomsandbarnacles.com. That's bloomsandbarnacles.com. If you've enjoyed our podcast, you can do one of three things to help support us. Number one, please donate at bloomsandbarnacles.com. The PayPal donate button is at the upper right-hand corner of the page. This helps us pay for coffee and for hosting fees. Two, rate and review us on Apple Podcasts or the podcast app of your choice. This helps more people find our show. And three, share us with a friend who you think would enjoy Blooms and Barnacles. Blooms and Barnacles is also a blog. We post new articles and original artwork semi-regularly at bloomsandbarnacles.com. Never miss an update by following us on social media. Search for our group, Blooms and Barnacles Podcast, on Facebook, or follow us on Twitter at BarnacleCast. You can also send us an email at bloomsandbarnacles@gmail.com. That's bloomsandbarnacles@gmail.com. We met some of our favorite podcast friends through random emails and social media DMs. We'd love to hear from you too, so don't be afraid to shoot us a message anytime. We'll be back in your feed in 2 weeks. Bye for now.